Mom blasted home in Gaddafi's Tripoli headquarters complex, a crutch in her hand. Her tone was sharp and defiant. Safia Gaddafi said she would forever consider the United States her enemy, unless they give Reagan the death sentence. Kate commented, "It's rare for a woman in a fundamentalist Muslim country to make a public appearance." "Well, if your house is blown up, you have to go out in public."
"I never thought of that. You're so clever."
"Thanks." I looked back at the article and read aloud. "She said, if I ever find the U.S. pilot who dropped the bombs on my house, I will kill him myself." I said to Kate, "So there you have it. These people don't hide anything. The problem is we take it as rhetoric, but they mean it literally, as Colonel Hambrecht and General Wycliffe discovered." She nodded. I added, "I can't believe the hotshots in Washington didn't know this was coming, or didn't know it had arrived." She didn't reply. I continued reading. "As for her husband, he is no terrorist," she explained, "because if he were, I would not have children with him." I commented, "Terrorists can make good fathers. That's a sexist statement." Kate replied, "Can you just read the fucking article without stupid comments?" "Yes, ma'am." I read, "Libyan officials said two of Gaddafi's sons were injured in the bombing, one of whom is still in the hospital. Safia Gaddafi stated, 'Some of my children are injured, some are scared. Maybe they have psychological damage.'" Kate said, "Maybe some other children also had psychological damage." "No maybes about it. I think we have a handle on how little Assad Khalil got fucked up in the head."
"I think so."
We both sat there, digesting yesterday's news. It's always good to know why. Now we knew why. We also knew who, what, where, and when. Assad Khalil, assassination mission, in America, now. However, we didn't know precisely where he was and where he would strike next. But we were close. And for the first time, I felt confident that we had the son of a bitch. I said to Kate, "If he hasn't flown out of the country, he's ours." She didn't comment on this optimistic remark, and given the history of Assad Khalil, I had a few doubts myself. I thought again about Mrs. Gaddafi's remarks and about the supposed relationship between the Gaddafis and the Khalils, which may have been closer than Mrs. Gaddafi knew. I thought, too, about the theory that Muammar had Captain Khalil killed in Paris long ago, and that Assad obviously didn't know or suspect this. I wondered, too, if little Assad knew that Uncle Muammar was sneaking out of his tent at night and tiptoeing across the sand to Mommy's tent. I had a college prof once who said that a lot of major world historical events have been influenced by sex, marital, and illicit. I know this is true regarding my own history, so why not the history of the world? I tried to imagine this Libyan elite, and they probably didn't differ much from other small autocracies where court intrigue, palace rumors, and power plays were the daily order of business. I asked Kate, "Do you think Assad Khalil had family members killed in that attack?" She replied, "If our information about the Khalil family relationship with the Gaddafis is correct, then we can assume the Khalils were in that compound, Al-Azizia, where, according to Mrs. Hambrecht, four American aircraft dropped bombs. Khalil has killed apparently two men who bombed Al-Azizia. He may have done that to avenge the Gaddafis, but yes, I think he and his family were there, and I think he may have suffered a personal loss." That's what I think. I tried to picture this guy, Assad Khalil, being blown out of his bed at some early morning hour, being scared shitless as the world around him was reduced to rubble. He must have seen lots of dead bodies and pieces of bodies. I made the assumption that he'd lost family members, and I tried to imagine his state of mind. Fright. Shock, maybe survivor's guilt, then in the end, anger. Finally, at some point, he decided to get even, and he was in a good position to do that, being a victim as well as being part of the inner circle. Libyan intelligence must have jumped on this kid like he was a new prophet. And Khalil himself. He's been carrying a grudge all his life, and since Saturday he's been living his dream. His dream, our nightmare. "What are you thinking about?" "Khalil? How he got from there to here? He's been fantasizing about coming to America all his life, and we didn't know it, though we should have.
And he's not here to start a new life, or to drive a taxi, or to escape persecution or economic misery. He is not who Emma Lazarus had in mind. Indeed not. And there are more of him out there. Indeed there are. So we remained at our posts as we were told to do, but I'm not good at sitting and reading and answering dumb phone calls. I wanted to call Beth, but the situation across my desk had changed, so I emailed Ms. Penrose the following. Can't talk now. Big break in case. Maybe out of town this PM. Thanks for big wet kiss. I hesitated at my keyboard. So in conclusion, no, that wasn't good. Finally, I typed, need to talk to you. We'll call soon. I hesitated again, then sent the message. Need to talk, of course, says it all if you've been there. Lover's shorthand, as per my wife. John, we need to talk, i.e., fuck you. Kate asked, who are you emailing? Beth Penrose. Silence, then, I hope you didn't use email to tell her. No. That's really cold. How about a fax? You have to tell her in person. In person? I don't even have the time to talk to me in person. Well, a phone call will do. I'll leave. No, I'll handle it later. Unless you don't want to. I understand. I felt a headache coming on. Really, I understand if you've had second thoughts. Why did I not believe this? What happened last night does not obligate you in any way. We're both adults, so we'll just cool it a while and take it slow, step at a time. Are you out of cliches yet? Go to hell. She stood and walked away. I would have jumped up and followed her, but I think we'd already attracted some attention from our co-workers, so I just smiled and whistled God Bless America while members of the ATTF Anti-Sex League emailed Big Brother about a possible sex crime in progress. Which reminded me that I needed clean undershorts. There was a men's shop close by, and I'd planned a quick stop there later. I was going to let Kate help me pick out a shirt and tie. Anyway, back to the most wanted terrorist in America. I accessed my email and saw a message from the counterterrorism section in D.C. marked urgent. The distribution was limited to only those in the Incident Command Center. I read from the screen, Air Force informs us it may be difficult to ID pilots who flew Al-Azizia mission. Records exist for full squadrons and larger units, but smaller subunits need further research. I thought about this. It had the ring of truth, but I was so paranoid by now I wouldn't believe an exit sign. I read the remainder of the communique. We have passed on to Air Force substance of Rose Hambrecht's telephone interview with New York agents, i.e. four aircraft, F-111s, on Al-Azizia mission, eight airmen. General Wycliffe murder, etc., see prior comm on this. AF personnel and historian office are researching names as per above para. Mrs. Hambrecht has been phone contacted but will not divulge names via phone. A general officer with escort has been dispatched from Wright-Patterson AFB, Dayton, Ohio, to Hambrecht home, Ann Arbor. Mrs. Hambrecht says she will divulge names to them in person with proper ID and waivers, etc. Will advise. I printed out the email, circled urgent in red, and threw it on Kate's desk. I thought about this situation. First of all, Mrs. H was a tough cookie, and no phone threats, pleas, or cajoling were going to make her do what she'd been told not to do since she'd become an Air Force wife long ago. Secondly, it occurred to me that, ironically, the security that had been put in place to protect these airmen from retaliation was the same security that had kept us from understanding what was going on, and now was hindering us from protecting them. Also, it was obvious that the security had already been breached at some point. That's why Asad Khalil had a list of names and we didn't. And what names did he have? Only those eight airmen on the Al-Azizia mission? Probably. Those were the guys he wanted to whack. And did he have all eight names? Probably. I ran this through my mind. Eight men, one killed in the Gulf, one murdered in England, one murdered with his wife in their home on Capitol Hill, of all places. One had a serious illness, according to Mrs. Hambrecht. That left four probable victims. Five, if the sick guy didn't die before Khalil killed him. But I had no doubt, as I'd said, that some of them were already dead. Maybe all of them, plus anyone around them who was in the wrong place at the wrong time, like Mrs. Wycliffe and the housekeeper. It's a little disturbing when your own country becomes the front lines. I don't pray often, and never for myself. But I prayed for those guys and their families. I prayed for the known dead, the probable dead, and the soon-to-be dead. Then I had a brilliant idea, checked my personal telephone book, and dialed a number. Chapter 45. The Learjet continued its climb out of Colorado Springs. Asad Khalil moved to the port side of the aircraft and sat in the last seat. He stared out at the towering mountains as the aircraft continued north. It seemed to him that they had already climbed above the height of the tallest mountain, yet the aircraft continued straight ahead. In fact, he could now see the large, lighted expanse of Denver ahead. He considered the possibility that the pilots may have been radioed a warning, and that they would feign a mechanical problem and land at some isolated airfield where the authorities were waiting for him. There was a quick and simple way to find out. He stood and walked up the aisle to the cockpit. The partition was still open, and Khalil stood behind and between the two pilots. He said to them, "Are there any problems?" Captain Fisk glanced over his shoulder and replied, "No, sir. Everything's fine." Khalil studied the two pilots closely. He could always tell when someone was lying to him or when someone was uneasy, no matter how good an actor that person thought he or she was. There appeared to be nothing in the manner of these two men that betrayed a problem, though he would like to have been able to see into their eyes. Captain Fisk said, "We're beginning our turn west over the mountains. We'll get some mountain turbulence, Mr. Perlman, so you may want to return to your seat." Khalil turned and went back to his seat. The seatbelt sign, which the captain had not used before, went on as a bell chimed. The Lear banked to the left, then leveled off and continued on. Within a few minutes, the aircraft began to be buffeted by updrafts. Khalil could feel the jet continuing to gain altitude, its nose pointing up at a sharp angle. The pilot came on the intercom and said, "We've just gotten our direct clearance for San Diego. En route time should be 1 hour and 50 minutes, which will put us on the ground at approximately 6:15 a.m. California time. That's an hour earlier than mountain time, sir." "Thank you. I think I understand the time zones now." "Yes, sir." In fact, Khalil thought, he had been traveling with the sun since Paris, and the earlier time changes had given him some extra hours, though he didn't particularly need them. His next time change would take him across the international dateline, over the Pacific Ocean, and as Malik had said, "When you cross that line, the captain will announce this, and Mecca will be to the west, not in the east. Begin your prayers facing east and end them facing west. God will hear you from both his ears, and you will be assured a safe journey home." Khalil settled back in his leather seat, and his thoughts turned from Malik to Boris. It was Boris, he realized, who was more on his mind than Malik these last few days. Boris had been his primary briefing officer in regard to America and American customs, so it was natural now for Khalil to think more of Boris than of the others who had trained his mind, body, and soul for this mission. Boris had trained him to understand the decadent culture in which Asad Khalil now found himself, though Boris did not always find American culture so decadent. Boris had told him, "There are actually many cultures in America, from very high to very low. Also, there are many people such as yourself, Asad, who believe deeply in God, and there are those who believe only in pleasure, money, and sex. There are patriots and those who show disloyalty to the central government. There are honest men and thieves. The average American is basically more honest than the thieving Libyans I've dealt with, despite your love of Allah. Do not underestimate the Americans. They've been underestimated by the British, the French, the Japanese warlords, Adolf Hitler, and by my former government. The British and French empires are gone. So is Hitler, the Japanese empire, and the Soviet empire. The Americans are still very much with us." Khalil recalled replying to Boris,
the next century belongs to Islam. Boris laughed and said, You've been saying that for 1,000 years. I'll tell you what is going to defeat you. Your women. They are not going to put up with your nonsense much longer. The slaves will turn on their masters. I saw it happen in my country. One day your women will become tired of wearing veils, tired of being beaten, tired of being killed for fucking a man, tired of sitting home wasting their lives. When that day comes, people like you and your fucking mullahs had better be ready to negotiate. If you were a Muslim, that would be blasphemy, and I would kill you right now. To which Boris had replied, Yob vas, then buried his fist in Khalil's solar plexus and walked away, leaving Khalil doubled over, gasping for air. Khalil recalled that neither man spoke of the incident again, but both knew that Boris was already a dead man, so the incident needed no further resolution. It was the equivalent of a condemned prisoner spitting in the eye of the man who would behead him. The aircraft was still climbing and still being tossed about by the mountain winds. Khalil looked down and saw the moonlit peaks of the snow-capped mountains, but the moonlight did not penetrate into the dark valleys. He again settled into his seat and again thought of Boris. Boris, for all his blasphemies, his drunkenness, and his arrogance, had proved to be a good teacher. Boris knew America and Americans. His knowledge, Khalil had once discovered, had not been entirely accumulated during his time in America. Boris, in fact, had once worked in a secret training camp in Russia, a KGB facility called, Khalil remember, Mrs. Ivanova's Charm School, where Russian spies had learned to become Americans. Boris had mentioned the secret to him once in a drunken moment, of course, and told him that this was one of the last great secrets that had never been revealed by the old KGB after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Americans, too, according to Boris, wanted this secret forever buried. Khalil had no idea what Boris was talking about, and Boris would not mention it again, even after much prodding by Khalil. In any case, during Boris's time in that school, he claimed to have come to an understanding of the American soul and psyche beyond anything he'd learned by living in America. In fact, Boris had once said, There are times when I think I am an American. I remember once going to a baseball game in Baltimore, and when the Star Spangled Banner was played, I stood and felt tears forming in my eyes. Boris added, Of course, I still feel the same way when I hear the Internationale. He smiled and said, Perhaps I have developed multiple personalities. Khalil recalled telling Boris, As long as you don't develop multiple loyalties, you will be much happier and much healthier. The intercom crackled, breaking into Khalil's memories of Boris. Captain Fisk said, Mr. Perlman, I apologize for the turbulence, but this is typical of a mountain range. Khalil wondered why the pilot would apologize for something that God, not he, controlled. Captain Fisk continued, The air should smooth out in about 20 minutes. Our flight plan tonight will take us southwest across Colorado, then over what is known as the Four Corners, the place where the state borders of Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, and Utah come together. Then we continue southwest across the northern portion of Arizona. Unfortunately, you won't be able to see much after the moon sets, but you should be able to make out the desert and high plateaus. Khalil had seen more desert in his life than these two had seen in their combined lives. He picked up his intercom and said, Please let me know when we are passing over the Grand Canyon. Yes, sir. Hold on a moment. Okay, in 40 minutes we'll pass approximately 50 miles south of the South Rim. You may be able to see the general area of the canyon from the right side and certainly the high plateau beyond, but I'm afraid it won't be a very clear view from this altitude and distance. Khalil had no interest at all in seeing the Grand Canyon. He was only assuring himself of a wake-up call in the event he fell asleep. He said, Thank you. Don't hesitate to wake me when we approach the canyon. Yes, sir. Khalil tilted back his seat and closed his eyes. He thought again of Colonel Callum and was convinced he had made the correct decision in letting the Angel of Death deal with that murderer. He thought, too, of his next visit, to Lieutenant Wiggins. Wiggins, they had told him in Tripoli, was a man of erratic movements, unlike the men of habit and predictable existence that he had already killed. For this reason, and because Wiggins came at the end of his list, there would be someone in California to assist him. Khalil did not want or need assistance, but this portion of his mission was the most critical, the most dangerous, and also, as the world would soon discover, the most important. Khalil felt himself falling into a sleep, and he dreamed again of a man who was stalking him. It was a confusing dream in which both he and the man were flying over the desert, Khalil in the lead, the man behind him, but out of sight. And flying over both of them was the angel of death that he had seen in the Kufra oasis. The angel, he sensed, was contemplating which man he would touch and make fall to the earth. This dream somehow transformed into a dream of him and the lady pilot flying naked, hand in hand, looking for a flat rooftop on which to alight so they could engage in carnal pleasure. Each building they saw below had been destroyed by a bomb. The intercom crackled, and Khalil awoke with a start, sweat on his face, and his organ aroused. The pilot said, "Grand Canyon, coming up on your right, Mr. Perlman." Khalil took a long breath, cleared his throat, and said into the intercom, "Thank you." He rose and went into the lavatory. As he washed his face and hands in cold water, the dreams continued to run through his mind. He returned to his seat and glanced out the window. The full moon had nearly set on the horizon, and the earth below was black. He reached for the airphone and dialed a number from memory. A man's voice answered, "Hello?" Khalil said, "This is Perlman. I'm sorry to have awakened you." The man replied, "This is Tannenbaum. It is no problem. I sleep alone." "Good. I'm calling to see if we have business to do." The man said, "The business climate is good here." "And where are our competitors?" "They are nowhere to be seen." The rehearsed exchange complete, Khalil concluded with, "I look forward to our meeting." "As planned." Khalil hung up and drew a deep breath, then picked up the intercom. The captain answered, "Yes, Mr. Perlman." Khalil said, "My phone call has necessitated another change of plans." "Yes, sir." Boris had said to Khalil, "Mr. Perlman should not be overly apologetic when he keeps changing his flight plans. Mr. Perlman is Jewish, and he is paying good money, and he wants service for his money. Business comes first, and everyone else's inconvenience is of no concern to him." Khalil said to the pilot, "I need now to go to Santa Monica. I assume that is not a problem." The pilot replied, "No, sir. There isn't much difference in flight time from our present position." Khalil already knew that. "Good." Captain Fisk continued, "There won't be any delay with air traffic control at this hour." "What is our flight time to Santa Monica?" "I'm putting in the coordinates now, sir." "Okay, our flight time will be about 40 minutes, which will get us near the municipal airport at about 6 a.m. We may have to slow up en route to be sure to land after 6 because of the noise curfew." "I understand." 20 minutes later, the Learjet began its descent, and Khalil could see a low range of mountains in the soft glow of the sunrise behind him. Captain Fisk came on the intercom and said, "We are beginning our descent, sir, so you may want to fasten your seatbelt. Those are the San Bernardino Mountains ahead. Also, you can see the lights from the eastern edge of Los Angeles below. Santa Monica Airport is to your left front, near where the coast meets the ocean. We'll be on the ground in 10 minutes. Khalil did not reply. He felt the aircraft steepening its descent, and he could see enormous ribbons of lighted highways and roads below. He set his wristwatch to California time, which was now 5:55 a.m. He heard the pilot speaking on the radio, but could not hear the other end of the conversation because the pilots were listening on their earphones. They had not always used the earphones during the flight from New York, and Khalil had now and then been able to hear radio transmissions. He was not suspicious regarding the earphones, but it was worth noting in the event that other small deviations developed. This flight had been planned in Tripoli so that his change of destination, announced over the Grand Canyon, would put him in Santa Monica no later, or even a few minutes earlier than if he'd landed in San Diego, and no earlier than the noise curfew allowed. If they were waiting for him in San Diego and they discovered that he was going to Santa Monica, they had less than 40 minutes to set a trap there. If it took longer to put the trap into place, the pilot would inform him of some delay, and Asad Khalil would make another request for a flight plan change, this time with a pistol to the pilot's head. Their alternate airport would be a small, abandoned facility in the San Bernardino Mountains, only a few minutes' flying time from where they were now. A car with keys taped under the wheel well was waiting for him there. The authorities would soon learn who had the advantage. It was Asad Khalil in a private jet aircraft with a pistol. They flew out over the ocean, then turned back toward the coast and continued their descent. He waited for some indication of a delay in landing, but then he heard the Lear's landing gear being lowered, then watched the flaps extend from the back of the wing. Landing lights blinked on the tips of the wings and flashed into the cabin through the portholes. All of these changes in flight plans, he knew, was no assurance that he would be safe on the ground. But since the possibility existed to change plans almost at will, it was decided to do so, if for no other reason than to make life more difficult for the Americans if they were trying to trap him. Malik had shown him two interesting films. In the first film, shown in slow motion, a lion was in full pursuit of a gazelle. The gazelle changed course to the left, and Malik said, "Notice that the lion does not overcompensate in his turn to the left in order to intercept his prey. The lion knows that the gazelle can change direction quickly to the right, and the lion will overshoot his prey and lose him. The lion only changes directions at the same angle as his prey and follows directly behind him. He will not be fooled, and he knows that his speed will overtake even the gazelle as long as he focuses on the animal's rear legs." The film ended with the lion leaping onto the haunches of the gazelle, who collapsed under the weight of his pursuer and waited quietly for his death. The next film showed a lion being pursued across a grassy plain by a Land Rover, in which two men and two women rode. The people in the vehicle, according to the narrator, were trying to get close enough to the lion to shoot a tranquilizing dart into him so that he could be captured for some scientific purpose. This film, too, was in slow motion, and Khalil noticed that the lion at first tried to rely on its speed to outdistance the vehicle, but as the lion tired, he changed direction to the right, and the vehicle went to the right as well, but at a steeper angle, in order to intercept the lion. But the lion, who was now in the position of a gazelle, knew by instinct and experience what the vehicle was doing, and the lion suddenly veered to the left, and the vehicle found itself far to the right of the retreating lion. The film ended, and Khalil never knew if the lion escaped. Malik had said, "The lion, when he is the hunter, remains focused on his prey. The lion, as the hunted, relies on his knowledge and instincts as a hunter to trick his pursuers. There are times when you must change directions to avoid your pursuers, and times when an unnecessary change of direction allows your prey to escape. The worst change of direction is that which leads you directly into a trap. Know when to change course, and when to increase your speed, and when to slow your pace if you smell danger ahead. Know, too, when to stop and blend into the bush. A gazelle who has escaped the lion quickly goes back to its mindless grazing. The gazelle is happy filling its belly with grass and not exerting itself. The lion still wants its meat and will wait for the gazelle to get even fatter and slower." The Learjet passed over the threshold of the runway, and Khalil looked out the porthole as the aircraft touched down on the concrete landing strip. The Lear came to a quick stop, then exited onto a taxiway. A few minutes later, the Learjet taxied up to a nearly deserted general aviation ramp. Khalil watched closely through the cabin window, then stood, picked up his bag, walked to the front of the aircraft, and knelt behind the pilots. He scanned the scene through the cockpit windows and saw a man in front of them holding a set of lighted wands to guide the aircraft into a parking spot directly in front of the facility building. Captain Fisk shut down the engines and said to his passenger, "Here we are, Mr. Perlman. Do you need a ride somewhere?" "No. I am being met. Though
I don't know by whom. Khalil continued to look through the cockpit windows. The co-pilot, Sanford, unfastened his harness, stood, and excused himself as he slid past his passenger. Sanford opened the cabin door and a soft breeze blew into the aircraft. Sanford then stepped out of the aircraft and Asad Khalil followed him, ready to say goodbye or to shoot the man in the head, depending on what happened in the next few seconds. Captain Fisk also exited the aircraft and the three men stood together in the cool dawn air. Khalil said, I am to meet my colleague in the coffee shop. Yes, sir, said Captain Fisk. There was a coffee shop in that two-story building last time I was here. Should be open now. Khalil's eyes darted around at the hangars and the maintenance buildings, still in early morning shadow. Captain Fisk said, Over there, sir, that building with all the windows. Yes, I see it. He looked at his watch and said to Captain Fisk, I will be driven to Burbank. How long will the drive be? Both pilots considered the question, then Terry Sanford replied, Well, Burbank Airport is only about 12 miles north of here, so it shouldn't take long by car at this hour. Maybe 20, 30 minutes? In case the pilots were wondering, Khalil said, Perhaps I should have gone directly to the airport there. Well, the noise curfew there lifts at 7 a.m. Ah, then that's why my colleague instructed me to meet him here. Yes, sir, probably. In fact, Khalil knew all of this, and he smiled to himself at the thought of his pilots discovering some time in the future that their passenger was not as ignorant as they themselves had been regarding his flight plans. He said to them, Thank you. He addressed both men and said, And I thank you for your assistance and your company. Both pilots replied that it had been a pleasure having him on board. Khalil doubted their sincerity, but he gave each man $100 in cash and said, I will request you both the next time I need your service. They thanked Mr. Perlman, touched their caps, and walked off toward the open hangar. Asad Khalil stood alone, exposed on the open ramp, and waited for the quiet to explode into screaming and running men. But nothing happened, which did not surprise him. He sensed no danger and felt the presence of God in the rising sun. He walked unhurriedly toward the glass building to the right of the hangar and entered. He found the coffee shop and saw a man sitting alone at a table. The man wore jeans and a blue t-shirt and was reading the Los Angeles Times. Like himself, the man had Semitic features and was about his age. Asad Khalil approached the man and said, Mr. Tannenbaum. The man stood. Yes, Mr. Perlman. They shook hands and the man who called himself Tannenbaum asked, Would you like coffee? I think we should go. Khalil exited the coffee shop. The man paid for his coffee at the cash register and met Mr. Perlman outside the coffee shop. They left the building and began walking to the parking lot. Mr. Tannenbaum, still speaking English, inquired, You have had a good journey. If I had not, would I be here? The man didn't reply. He sensed that this compatriot walking beside him was not looking for companionship or idle talk. Khalil asked, Are you sure you weren't followed? Yes, I'm certain. I am not involved in anything that would cause me to come to the attention of the authorities. Khalil replied in Arabic, You are not now involved in any such thing. Do not make any such assumptions, my friend. The man answered in Arabic, Of course. I apologize. They approached a blue van parked in the lot. On the side of the van were the words Rapid Delivery Service, local and statewide, guaranteed same or next day delivery, followed by a phone number. The man unlocked the doors and got into the driver's seat. Khalil climbed into the passenger seat and glanced into the rear of the van where a dozen packages sat on the floor. The man started the engine and said, Please fasten your seatbelt to avoid being stopped by the police. Khalil fastened his seatbelt, keeping his black bag on his lap. He said, Route 405, north. The man put the van in gear and drove out of the lot, then out of the municipal airport. Within a few minutes, they were on a wide interstate, heading north. Khalil and the driver both looked in their side view mirrors as they gathered speed. The sky had lightened, and Khalil looked around as they continued north.
He saw exit signs for Century City, 20th Century Fox Studios, West Hollywood, Beverly Hills, and something called UCLA. Khalil knew that Hollywood was where the American movies were made, but he had no interest in that subject, and his driver volunteered no information. The driver said, "I have parcels in the rear addressed to Mr. Perlman." Khalil did not reply. The driver added, "Of course, I do not know what is in them, but I trust you will find everything you need." Again, Khalil made no reply. The driver remained quiet, and Khalil saw that the man was becoming uneasy, so Khalil addressed him by his real name and said, "So, Azim, you are from Benghazi?" "Yes." "Do you miss your country?" "Of course." "And you miss your family? Your father, I believe, is still living in Libya." Azim hesitated, then replied, "Yes." "Soon you will be able to pay for a visit home, and you can shower your family with gifts." "Yes." They drove in silence a while, both continuing to glance at the side view mirrors. They approached an interchange where the interstate crossed the Ventura Freeway. To the east was Burbank, and to the west led to Ventura. Azim said, "I was told you had the address of your meeting." Khalil replied, "I was told you had the address." Azim nearly ran the van off the road and began sputtering, No, I know nothing. They told me." Khalil laughed and put his hand on Azim's shoulder. "Oh, yes. I forgot. I have the address. Take the exit for Ventura." Azim forced a smile and a small laugh, then slowed into the right-hand lane and took the exit for Ventura. Asad Khalil looked at the wide valley filled with houses and commercial buildings, then looked off at the high hills in the distance. He noted, too, the palm trees, which reminded him of home. Khalil dismissed his thoughts of home and thought of his next meal. Elwood Wiggins had been an elusive prey, but eventually he had been located in Burbank, then had unexpectedly moved to the place called Ventura further north up the coast. In fact, this move was fateful and placed Wiggins closer to where Asad Khalil intended to end his visit to America. Khalil could not doubt that the hand of Allah was moving the last few players of the game into place. If Lieutenant Wiggins was at home, then Asad Khalil could finish this business today and move on to unfinished business. If Lieutenant Elwood Wiggins was not at home, then when he ultimately returned home, he would find in his house a hungry lion waiting to rip out his throat. Khalil let out a small laugh, and Azim glanced at him and smiled, but Azim's smile quickly faded as he saw the expression that had accompanied the laugh. Azim felt the hairs on his neck rise as he stared at his passenger, who had seemed to transform from man to beast. Chapter 46. I dialed a Washington, D.C. number and a voice came on the line. "Homicide, Detective Kellum." I replied, "This is John Corey, NYPD, Homicide. I'm looking for Detective Calvin Childers." "He has an alibi for that night." "Everyone's a comedian." I played the game and replied, "He's black, he's armed, and he's mine." Kellum laughed and said, "Hold on." I waited a minute and Calvin Childers came on the line. "Hey, John, how's it going on the Big Apple?" "Just peachy, Cal. Same old shit." The pleasantries over, I said, "I'm actually working on the transcontinental thing." "Well, whoop-de-doo. How'd you get a piece of that?" "It's a long story. To tell you the truth, I'm working for the FBI now." "I knew you'd amount to no good." We both chuckled. Cal Childers and I had attended the previously mentioned seminar at FBI headquarters some years ago, and we took a liking to each other for reasons that had to do mostly with our problems with authority and feds. It was Cal who told me the stupid attorney general joke. I said to him, "You ever find out who killed the Wheaties?" He laughed and said, "Hey, were those guys stiff or what? They sat there and never cracked a smile. You working for those turkeys?" "I'm on a short contract and a shorter leash." "Yeah. So what can I do for you?" "Well,
You want me to be straight, or should I try to bullshit you so that the less you know, the better? Are we on the air? Probably. You got a cell phone? Sure do. Call me back. He gave me his direct dial. I hung up and said to Kate, who had returned from wherever it is that women stomp off to, "Excuse me, may I borrow your cell phone?" She was doing something on her computer, and without a word or a glance, she reached into her jacket and handed me her cell phone. "Thank you," I said. I dialed Calvin's direct number, he answered, and I said, "Okay. Are you working the General Wycliffe case?" "Nope, but I know the guys who are." "Good. You guys got any leads?" "No. Do you?" "I have the name of the killer."
"Yeah? He in custody?"
"Not yet. That's why I need your help."
"Sure. Give me the name of the killer."
"Sure. Give me some help." Cal laughed. "Okay. What do you need?" "Here's the deal. I need the names of some guys who flew a bombing mission with the deceased general. I'll tell you straight, these names are top secret, and the Air Force and DOD are stonewalling or dragging their feet, or maybe they don't know."
"Then how am I supposed to know?"
"Well, you can casually ask the family, or you can go to the deceased's house and look around. Look in his address book or in his files. Maybe there's a photo or something like that."
"I thought you were a detective."
"I'm a detective, not a fucking mind reader. Give me more." "Right. The bombing mission was on a place in Libya called..." I looked at a news article on my desk and said, "Al-Azizia." "I got a nephew named Al-Azizia." "Did I say we both had a weird sense of humor?" I said, "It's a place, Cal, in Libya, near Tripoli."
"Oh yeah, why didn't you say so? Now it's all clear."
"The thing is, I'm pretty sure that General Wycliffe was murdered by this guy, Asad Khalil."
"The guy who offed the whole plane?"
"That's the guy."
"What the hell is he doing in D.C.?"
"Murdering people? He's on the move. I think he wants to whack all the pilots and crew who participated in this raid on Al-Azizia."
"No shit. Why?"
"Because he wants revenge. I think he lived in this place, and maybe some of those bombs killed people he knew. Understand?"
"Yeah. So now he's getting some payback."
"Right. The bombing mission was on April 15, 1986. There were four aircraft involved, F-111s, two-man crews for a total of 8 guys. One guy, Colonel William Hambrecht, was axe-murdered near Lackenheath Air Base in England in January. Then there's General Wycliffe, who was on the raid. Another guy, whose name I don't know, was killed in the Gulf War. So now you have two names, Hambrecht and Wycliffe. Maybe there's a group photo or something."
"Got it."
After a second or two, he said, "Why'd this guy wait so long to even the score? He was a kid at the time. Now he's all grown up." I gave Cal a brief history of Asad Khalil, the defection in Paris, and other stuff that wasn't in the news. Cal said, "Hey, if this perp was collared in Paris, you must have prints and stuff."
"Good point.
Get the FBI lab to send you all they have. They even have fibers from the suit he might have been wearing in D.C. They also have DNA and some other stuff."
"No shit."
"Yeah, they have that too." He laughed and said, "We haven't turned up much at the murder scene, but if this guy Khalil did it, at least forensics can know what they're looking for when the FBI sends prints and fibers and all that."
"Right.
Were the victims killed with a .40 caliber?"
"No, a .45. The general had a military .45 automatic, and it's missing, according to his daughter."
"I thought you weren't working this case."
"I'm not, directly. But it's a big case."
"White folks, you know."
"I know. Well, they can't pin this one on you."
He laughed again. "Tell you what, give me a few hours."
"An hour tops, Cal. There are other guys out there who need to be covered. We're probably too late for some of them already."
"Yeah, okay. I've got to get a hold of the guys working the case, and I'll go over to the victim's house myself and call you from there, okay?"
"I appreciate it."
I gave him Kate's cell phone number and added, "Keep this to yourself." He said, "You owe me."
"I already paid. Asad Khalil, that's your killer."
"It better be, buddy. I'm sticking my ass out with this.
I'll cover you."
"Yeah, the FBI always covers the cops."
"I'm still a cop."
"You better be."
He hung up. I put the cell phone down on my desk. Kate looked up from her computer and said, I heard all of that. Well, for the record, you didn't. It's okay. I think you're within bounds on that. That's a first. Don't get paranoid. You're allowed to explore all legitimate avenues of investigation. Even top secret stuff? No, but it appears that the perpetrator has this information and therefore it's already compromised. Are you sure? Trust me. I'm a lawyer. We both smiled. I guess we were pals again. We had a sort of tenuous conversation, the kind that lovers have after a little misunderstanding about one of the parties not getting rid of someone that he or she was screwing. We segued from that issue to business. Kate said, if we can get those names and maybe addresses from your friend before Mrs. Hambrick turns them over, or before the Air Force or DOD finds them, then we have a better shot at continuing to work this case. She added, as opposed to counterterrorism in Washington getting the names. I looked at her. Clearly Ms. Mayfield, team player, was rethinking how the game should be played. We made eye contact, and she smiled. I said, yeah. I hate it when people take things from me that are mine. She nodded, then said, you're actually quite clever. I never thought to call DC homicide. I'm a homicide cop. This is cop to cop. We do it all the time. Gabe just did it. I added, you were the one who thought to request Colonel Hambrecht's file. See? We work well together. FBI, cops, synergy. It works really well. What a concept. Why didn't I get into this outfit 10 years ago? When I think of all the time I wasted on the police force? John, cool it. Yes, ma'am. I'm ordering lunch. What would you like? Truffles on rye with béarnaise sauce. And pickles. How'd you like my fist down your throat? My goodness. I stood and stretched. Let me take you out for lunch. Well, I don't... Come on. I need to get out of here. We have beepers. I put Kate's cell phone in my pocket. All right. She stood and went over to the duty desk and told the woman there we'd be out and close by. We exited the ICC, and within a few minutes we were down on Broadway. It was still a nice sunny day, and the sidewalks were crowded with lunch hour people, mostly government workers eating from vending carts or brown bags to save a few bucks. Cops aren't exactly overpaid, but we know how to treat ourselves well. When you're on the job, you never know what the future may bring, so you eat, drink, and make merry. I didn't want to get too far from the Ministry of Truth, so I walked 2 blocks south to Chambers Street near City Hall. As we walked, Kate said, I'm sorry if I seemed a little upset before. That's not like me. Forget it. The first few days can be tough. Exactly. It doesn't get appreciably better, but why mention that and spoil the moment? I directed Ms. Mayfield to a place called Echo, and we entered. This is a sort of cozy place with a flavor of old New York, except for the prices. X and I used to come here since we both worked in the area, but I didn't mention that to Ms. Mayfield. I was greeted by name by the maitre d', which never fails to impress one's dining companions. The place was crowded, but we were escorted to a nice table for 2 near the front window. NYPD guys wearing suits and guns are treated well in New York restaurants, and I guess it's the same all over the world. Yet I'd have no problem giving up the perks and status for a nice retirement someplace in Florida. Right? Anyway, the place was full of politicos from City Hall and other city agencies. This is sort of a power place for the municipal elite on fat expense accounts, a place where the city's sales tax is recycled back into the private sector, momentarily, then cycled back to the city. It works really well. Kate and I ordered glasses of $8 wine from the proprietor, whose name was Enrico. White for the lady, red for the gentleman. After Enrico left, Kate said, You don't have to buy me an expensive lunch. Of course I did. I said, however, I really owe you a good lunch after that breakfast. She laughed. The wine came, and I said to Enrico, I might need to receive a fax here. Can you give me your number? Of course, Mr. Corey. Whereupon he wrote the fax number on a cocktail napkin and left. Kate and I touched glasses, and I said, Slain tea.
What's that mean?
To your health. It's Gaelic. I'm half Irish.
Which half?
The left side.
I mean, mother or father?
Mother. Pop is mostly English.
What a marriage that is. They send each other letter bombs.
She laughed and observed, New Yorkers are so concerned with national origins. You don't see that all over the country.
Really? That's boring.
Like that joke you told about Italians and Jehovah's Witnesses. It took me a few seconds to get it.
I have to introduce you to my ex-partner, Dom Fennelli. He's funnier than me.
And so forth. I've been here before, but this time it was different for some reason. We studied the menus, as they say, me studying the right side, Kate studying the left side. The right side was a little steeper than I'd remembered it, but I was saved by the ringing cell phone. I took it out of my pocket and said, Corey. Calvin Childers' voice said, Okay, I'm in the deceased's den, and there's a photograph here of eight guys in front of a jet fighter that someone tells me is an F-111. The date on the photo is April 13, and the year is 1987, not 86. Yeah, well, this was sort of a secret mission, so maybe. Yeah, I got it. Okay, but none of the guys in the photo is ID'd by name.
Damn.
Hold on, sport. Calvin's on the case. So then I find this big black and white photo labeled 48th Tactical Fighter Wing, Royal Air Force Station, Lackenheath. And there's about 50, 60 guys in the photo. And it's captioned with names, like first row, second row, and standing. So I put the magnifying glass to these faces, and I come up with the matches to the eight guys in the F-111 photo. Then I go back to the big photo and get the names of those eight guys from the caption. Seven guys. I already know what Wakeliff looks like. Okay, then I go into the deceased's personal phone book, and I get seven addresses and phone numbers. I let out a deep breath and said, Excellent. You want to fax those names and numbers to me?
What's in it for me?
Lunch in the White House? A medal? Whatever?
Yeah, probably time in Leavenworth.
Okay, there's a fax machine here in the deceased's office. Give me your fax number. I gave him the restaurant fax and said, Thanks, buddy. Good job. What do you think this guy Khalil is?
He's paying visits to those pilots.
Any in the D.C. area?
No.
Florida, South Carolina, New York.
Where in New York?
Let's see. Guy named Jim McCoy. Home is in a place called Woodbury. Office is Long Island Cradle of Aviation Museum.
Okay. What else?
You want me to fax this or read it?
Just fax it.
And fax the eight-guy photo while you're at it. And note who's who on the photo. And while you're at it, send me a good photo on a shuttle flight. Call me with a flight number, and I'll send an underemployed agent to pick it up.
You're a pain in the butt, Corey.
Okay, let me get out of here before I start attracting attention. He added, This Khalil guy is a nasty dude, Corey. I'll also send you some of the photos of the crime scene. I'll send you some photos of a plane load of corpses.
Watch your ass.
I always do.
See you at the White House.
I hung up. Kate looked at me and I said, We have all the names and addresses.
I hope we're not too late.
I'm sure we are. I called over a waiter and said, I need the check and I need you to get me a fax out of your machine, addressed to Corey. He disappeared. I knocked off my wine and Kate and I stood. I said, I owe you lunch. We moved toward the front door. The waiter came. I gave him a 20, and he gave me a 2-page handwritten fax and the faxed photo, which wasn't that clear. Kate and I went out to Chambers Street, and as we walked quickly back to Federal Plaza, I read the alphabetized names aloud. Bob Callum, Colorado Springs, Air Force Academy. Steve Cox, with a notation KIA, Gulf, January 1991. Paul Gray, Daytona Beach, Spruce Creek, Florida. Willie Hambrecht, we know about him. Jim McCoy in Woodbury, that's Long Island. Bill Satherwaite, Monk's Corner, South Carolina. Where the hell is that? And last, a guy named Chip Wiggins in Burbank, California, but Cal notes that this address and phone number were crossed out in Wakeliff's book. Kate said, I'm trying to figure out Khalil's movements. He leaves Kennedy Airport by taxi about 5:30 p.m., presumably in Gamal Jabbar's taxi.
Does he then go to Jim McCoy's house with Jabbar driving him? I don't know. We'll know when we call Jim McCoy. I dialed Jim McCoy's home number on the cell phone as we walked, but all I got was an answering machine. Not wanting to leave too alarming a message, I said, "Mr. McCoy, this is John Corey from the FBI. We have reason to believe that..." "What? The baddest motherfucker on the planet is gunning for your ass?" "That you may be the target of a man who is seeking revenge for your part in the 1986 raid on Libya. Please notify your local police and also call the FBI office there on Long Island. Here's my direct number in Manhattan." I gave it to him and added, "Please be extremely cautious. I advise you and your family to move immediately to another location." I hit the end button and said to Kate, "He may think the call was a hoax, but maybe the word Libya will convince him. Note the time of my call." She already had her pad out and was making notes. She said, "He may also never get that message." "Let's not think about that. Think positive." I stopped at a vending cart and said to the guy, "Two knishes, mustard and sauerkraut." I then dialed the home number of Bill Satherwaite in South Carolina. I said to Kate, "I'm calling the potential victims at their homes first before I call the local police. You can get hung up on the phone with a fuzz." "Right. I'll call their respective offices next." The phone rang and a recorded voice said, "Bill Satherwaite, leave a message." So I left a similar message to the one I left at the McCoy residence, ending with my advice to get out of town. The street vendor heard my message and eyed me suspiciously as he handed me and Kate each a knish wrapped in wax paper. I gave him a 10. Kate asked, "What's this?" "Food. Kind of Jewish mashed potatoes. Fried. It's good." I dialed Paul Gray's home number in Florida, noting that his home and business address were the same. Yet another answering machine instructed me to leave a message. I repeated my message, and the vendor guy stared at me as he handed me my change. Kate and I continued walking. I tried Gray's office number and heard, "Gray Simulation Software. We're not able to come to the phone," and so forth. I didn't like the fact that no one seemed to be home and Gray wasn't in his office. I left the same message, and again, Kate made a note of it. I then tried Satherwaite's business number, which was identified as Confederate Air Charter and Pilot Training. I got an answering machine with a sales pitch and a request to leave a number. I left my guarded message, which I noticed was becoming less guarded. I was tempted to scream into the phone, "Run for your life, buddy!" I hung up and said to Kate, "Where is everybody today?" She didn't reply. We were walking up Broadway, and Federal Plaza was a block away. I wolfed down half of my large knish in record time as I scanned the fax paper. Kate took a bite out of the knish, made a face, and deposited it in a trash receptacle without even offering it to me. My ex used to have the waiter take her half-finished food away without checking with me first. Not a good sign. I decided to try the number of the Long Island Cradle of Aviation Museum, knowing I'd get a human voice. A woman answered the phone. "Museum." I said, "Ma'am, this is John Corey, Federal Bureau of Investigation. I need to speak to Mr. James McCoy, the director. It's urgent." There was a long silence on the phone, and I knew what that meant. She said, "Mr. McCoy," I heard a small sob, "Mr. McCoy's dead." I looked at Kate and shook my head. I threw my knish in the gutter and spoke as we walked quickly up the block. "How did he die, ma'am?"
"He was murdered."
"When?"
"Monday night. The police are all over the museum. No one is allowed in the building."
"Where are you, ma'am?"
"I'm in the children's museum next door. I'm Mr. McCoy's secretary, and his line now rings here, so that..."
"Okay. How was he murdered?"
He was shot in one of the aircraft. There was another man with him. Do you want to speak to the police?"
"Not yet. Do you know who the other man was?"
"No. Well, yes. Mrs. McCoy said he was an old friend, but I can't remember."
I said, "Gray?"
"No."
"Satherwaite?"
"Yes, that's it, Satherwaite. Let me put the police on the phone."
"In a minute. You said he was shot in a plane?"
"Yes. He and his friend were sitting in a fighter, the F-111, and they were both..." "The guard, Mr. Bauer, was also murdered."
"Okay, I'll call back." I hung up and briefed Kate as we entered 26 Federal Plaza.
While we waited for the elevator, I called Bob Callum's house in Colorado Springs, and a woman answered. Callum residence.
Is this Mrs. Callum?
Yes, who is this?
Is Mr. Callum home?
Colonel Callum, who's calling?
This is John Corey, ma'am, of the FBI. I need to speak to your husband. It's urgent.
He's not feeling well today. He's resting.
But he's home.
Yes. What is this about?
The elevator came, but you can lose the signal on an elevator, so he didn't take it. I said to Mrs. Callum, ma'am, I'm going to put my partner on the line, Kate Mayfield. She can explain.
I put the phone to my chest and said to Kate, women talk better to women.
I handed Kate the cell phone and said to her, I'm going up. As I waited for the next elevator, I heard Kate introduce herself and say, Mrs. Callum, we have reason to believe that your husband is in potential danger. Please listen, then as soon as I'm finished, I want you to call the police and the FBI and call base security. Do you live on base? The elevator came and I got in, leaving the job in good hands. Up on the 26th floor, I moved quickly to the ICC and got to my desk. I dialed the number of Chip Wiggins in Burbank, hoping to get a forwarding number, but a recording informed me that the number had been disconnected and there was no further information available. I looked at the two fact sheets and noticed that Wycliffe, McCoy, and Satherwaite had already been murdered, Paul Gray wasn't coming to the phone, and Wiggins was missing. Hambrecht had been murdered in England in January, and I wondered if anyone at the time had thought about why. Stephen Cox was the only one to die a natural death, if you consider killed in action as natural for a fighter pilot. Mrs. Hambrecht had indicated that one of the men was very ill, and I guessed that was Callum. The next reunion of these eight guys didn't need a big room. I got on my computer, and remembering from past experience that homicides in some rural places in Florida are handled by the county sheriff's department, I discovered that Spruce Creek is in Volusia County. I got the phone number of the sheriff's office and dialed, waiting for some cracker to answer. Meanwhile, I knew I was supposed to alert the counterterrorism section in the Hoover Building ASAP, but a call like that could take an hour, followed by a mandatory written report, and my instinct was to call the potential victims first. In fact, it was more than instinct. It was my own standard operating procedure. If someone was looking to whack me, I'd want to be the first to know about it. Sheriff's Department, Deputy Foley speaking. The guy sounded like he was from my neck of the woods. Deputy, this is John Corey of the FBI field office in New York. I'm calling to report a murder threat against a Spruce Creek resident named Paul Gray.
Too late.
Okay. When and where? Can you identify yourself further?
Call me back through the switchboard here.
I gave him the general number and hung up. About 15 seconds later, the phone rang, and it was Deputy Sheriff Foley. He said, my computer says this is the number of the anti-terrorist task force.
That's right.
What's the angle?
I can't say until I hear what you have to say. National security.
Yeah, what's that mean?
This guy was definitely a New Yorker, and I played that card.
You from New York?
Yeah, how can you tell?
Wild guess. I was NYPD, homicide. I'm double-dipping.
I was a patrolman in the 106 in Queens. A lot of NYPD down here, working and retired. I'm a deputy sheriff.
Funny, right?
Hey, I might join you.
They love NYPD here. They think we know what we're doing.
He laughed.
So the bonding over, I said to him, tell me about the murder.
Okay, it took place in the victim's house, home office, Monday. Coroner put the time of death about noon, but the air conditioner was on, so maybe earlier. Body discovered at about 8:15 p.m. by us, acting on a tip from a woman named Stacy Mall. She's a private pilot who flew a customer from Jacksonville Municipal Airport to the victim's home. The house is on an airstrip in this fly-in community called Spruce Creek outside of Daytona Beach. The customer said he had business with the deceased.
Indeed he did.
Right. So this customer tells the lady pilot his name is Demetrius Polos, an antique dealer from Greece. But afterwards, this woman sees this photo in the newspaper and she thinks her customer was this guy Assad Khalil.
She got that right.
Jesus.
I mean, we thought she was hallucinating, but then we find this guy dead. Why'd Khalil want to whack this guy?
He has a thing about airplanes. I don't know.
What else?
Well, two gunshot wounds, one abdomen, one head. Also, the cleaning lady got it. Single shot to the back of the head.
Did you recover slugs or shell casings?
Only the slugs. .340 caliber.
Okay, I guess you notified the FBI.
Yeah. I mean, we didn't actually believe the Asad Khalil thing, but that aside, the victim seemed to be involved in some sort of defense work, and there could be some computer disks missing, according to the victim's girlfriend, who we located.
But did you report the possible Khalil connection to the FBI?
We did. To the Jacksonville field office. They informed us they were getting Asad Khalil sightings every 15 minutes.
He added, they didn't take it too seriously, but said they'd send an agent down.
Still waiting.
Right. So after Spruce Creek, this lady pilot flew her customer where?
Back to Jacksonville Municipal, then drove him to Jacksonville International. The guy said he was flying back to Greece.
I thought that over and asked, did you notify the Jacksonville PD?
Of course. You think I forgot everything I know?
They checked out the airport, manifests, ticket sales and all that, but no Demetrius Polos.
Okay, how long did the perp stay in the house with the victim?
The pilot said about half an hour.
I nodded. I could almost recreate that conversation between Asad Khalil and Paul Gray. I asked Sergeant Foley a few more questions and got a few more answers, but basically that was it. Except that some FBI agents in Jacksonville were in deep shit, but they didn't know it yet. Asad Khalil sightings every 15 minutes. But this one was real. I didn't know who Stacy Maul was, but I'd try to get her a few federal bucks for good citizenship.
Deputy Foley asked me, you closing in on this guy?
I think so. This is one bad motherfucker.
Really?
Hey, how's the weather in New York?
Perfect.
Fucking hot here.
By the way, the lady pilot said a customer would be back next week. Made a reservation to fly back to Spruce Creek.
Don't hold your breath.
Right. She also made a dinner date with him.
Tell her she's lucky to be alive.
Really?
Thanks. I hung up and noted next to Paul Gray's name, murdered, with the date and approximate time. That reunion just got smaller. In fact, maybe only Chip Wiggins would be there, unless Wiggins had moved east and already had a visit from Asad Khalil. Bob Callum was still alive in Colorado, and I wondered if Khalil had left him alive because he knew the man was, according to Mrs. Hambrecht, very ill, or because Khalil simply hadn't gotten to Colorado yet. And where was Wiggins? If we could save Wiggins' life, that would be a small victory in a game where the score was Lion 5, home team zip. Kate came into the cubicle and sat at her desk. She said, I stayed on the line with Mrs. Callum and held until she called the police and the Academy Provost Marshal on a second line. She said she has a gun and knows how to use it.
Good.
She said her husband was very ill. Cancer.
I nodded.
Do you think Khalil knows that?
I'm trying to figure out what he doesn't know. I said to her, I called the Daytona Beach police. Paul Gray was murdered Monday, about noon, maybe earlier.
Oh, my God.
I told her all of what Deputy Sheriff Foley told me, then said, the way I figure it, Khalil got in Jabbar's taxi, did not go to McCoy's Museum on Long Island, but got out of the area, which was smart, went directly to Perth Amboy, whacked Jabbar, got in a waiting car, drove to D.C., stayed someplace, went to Wycliffe's house, whacked the general, his wife, and housekeeper, then somehow got to Jacksonville Municipal Airport, took a private plane to Spruce Creek, whacked Paul Gray and his cleaning lady, then flew back in the private planes to Jacksonville, then, I guess, went to Monk's Corner. Satherwaite's business address is a charter flying service, so Khalil charters Satherwaite's plane with Satherwaite piloting, and they fly to Long Island for a reunion. Must have been an interesting flight. They get to Long Island, whack whack, he does them both in the museum, in an F-111, no less, and also whacks the guard. Fucking incredible.
Kate nodded.
And where did he go next? How did he leave Long Island?
I guess he could have flown out of MacArthur.
It's not international, so the security's not always tight.
But maybe I see a pattern of private planes.
I think that may be it. So he may be flying to Colorado Springs or to California in a private plane. She added, most likely a jet.
Maybe, but maybe he wants to quit while he's ahead before he loses big time and he's now on his way to Sandland.
We haven't given him much reason to lead him to believe he can't go for it all.
Good point. I took a pencil and started adding up the known dead,
not counting the gassed people on Flight 175. I said, "This guy is reducing the overpopulation on the East Coast." I put down my pencil and read, "Andy McGill, Nick, Nancy, and Meg Collins, Jabbar, Wakeliff, wife and housekeeper, Gray and cleaning lady, Satherwaite, McCoy, and a guard. That's unlucky 13. Don't forget Yusef Haddad. Right, scumbag accomplice, 14. And today's only Tuesday." Kate didn't reply. I handed her the fact sheets and said, "Except for Callum, who's covered, Wiggins is the last guy who is, or might be, alive and not covered." She glanced at the fact sheets and asked me, "Did you try Wiggins?" "Yeah, phone disconnected. Let's try to get him through Burbank directory information." She swiveled around and started banging away at her computer. "What's his real first name?" "I don't know. See what you can do. Call counterterrorism in D.C. while I play with this. Then call the L.A. field office. Then notify everyone here in the ICC.